Welcome to the Rad Season Podcast. I'm your host, Ollie Russell Cowan. I'm joined this week by professional BMX flatland rider, Terry Adams. Terry got hooked on BMX at 12 years old, growing up in Hammond, Louisiana, just outside New Orleans. He would race BMX, but what really stood out was BMX flatland. And by the time he was only 16, he was entering flatland contests as a pro. From pure determination and hard work, Terry set out on getting coverage in the magazines. This led to sponsorship deals and competing in flatland around the world. In 2005, he won X Games Gold, and he's been voted Ride BMX Magazine's number one rider 3 times. Terry's drive to promote BMX flatland has seen him on national TV shows such as Ellen and Glee. Now at 38, he's training harder than ever and has a packed schedule of events and demos worldwide. Let's jump into it. Terry, hey man, how are you?
Good, bro.
Thanks for coming on the show. Whereabouts are you at the moment?
I am at my home here in Hammond, Louisiana. Hammond is kind of nestled in between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. So kind of a smaller city here in Louisiana, but that's where I've always been from. It's never leaving. So that's where I'm at.
Nice, man. And I've seen some, you've been pretty busy doing a lot of training, and you've kind of got a setup within your house in the garage. Is that right? Where you train and.
Yeah. You know, I have a spot in the garage, and then I have a spot in my backyard that's like a paved like 25 by 25 area. So yeah, years ago I would go ride out in parking lots, and those days are kind of over. It just makes a lot more sense, and it's way more effective to just have a super flat spot here at home and get going on it day by day.
And have you kind of got like a set schedule? Are you kind of you're up pretty early and sort of straight into it, or?
Yeah, no. Wildly enough, I start at 3 a.m. these days. So,
oh, wow.
I start at 3 a.m. this morning, and I go straight into like an hour and a half workout, which included in there is like a 30-minute pool cardio.
Okay.
And then after the workout's over, then at 4:50 every morning, I do 25 minutes of meditation. After that, I eat my breakfast, and after breakfast, I start the day with riding, and that riding normally gets going around 8 o'clock every day.
Okay.
So.
And how come so early? I mean, I've been trying to get up like as early as I can before, you know, kids wake up and you can kind of do things, and it's pretty quiet in the house and stuff. Is it you sort of finding that, or?
Yeah, you know, it's what kind of works for me. I guess to each his own, but 3 a.m. is honestly, it's a bit extreme. At first it was starting at 5, and then it was starting at 4, and now I've kind of worked myself into 3 o'clock, which it sounds crazy, but I'm still getting a good 7-8 hours worth of sleep. So I'm gassed by the end of the day. So as soon as my head hits that pillow, I'm out. And for a couple reasons, I'm tired, and I know I'm starting at 3:30 every morning. So, and I really love getting in the full workout routine and meditation done before 5:30 a.m. That way I just feel like I'm, you know, ahead for the day, and I feel like I already kind of won the day. And then all I have left to do is ride and train and focus on that. So
nice. Cool, man. Well, I guess I'd love to kind of jump back into how you began BMX and where that all started.
Yeah, it was in the early 90s. The first time I was introduced to BMX, there was a guy that was, there was an overpass near my parents' house, and he would just get on top of the bike and do a surfer and go down the overpass every day. And being a little kid, 7, 8, 9 years old, I was definitely intrigued by what is this guy doing, you know. This is so rad. Sometimes my mom would be behind him in the car, and he would just go down this big overpass just standing on the handlebars basically all the way down. And eventually we followed him to a gas station, and the gas station is actually right down the street from here right now. And my mom asked if we could watch him ride, And she did that a couple times before we asked him what video we should order. And so he kind of directed us where to order the video from. And that's kind of where it all started. And the wild thing about that story is I spent so many years trying to find that dude. And the only place I knew his name, and I knew that that's where he used to ride. I didn't know where he lived. I didn't know who knew him. And I had always heard rumors that this guy went to jail for counterfeit money. And here we are like 25 plus years later. And I was searching for him, and I made a post online. And one of my followers from around here in my town knew where he was, gave me his number. And I was able to reconnect with that guy, thank him for showing me BMX so many years ago. And I did like a little YouTube video about it on my on my channel. So
that's crazy. And yeah, I mean, like then from that guy, I mean, that then sort of opened up to you getting into it. And then were you riding, like when you started, were you getting your friends involved too? Was that like a little crew of you? And
yeah, I started off racing BMX. There was like a BMX track. The first step was getting a BMX bike, and you know, I was trying to do tricks on it. I didn't really have anyone around me doing tricks at all. So somehow I found this BMX track, or my mom found it in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And that place is, you know, just about 35 minutes from me. So my mom was bringing me there every weekend. And eventually there was a couple guys that I noticed at the track that were just kind of like on the side of the track in the dirt, like trying tricks and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, as many trophies as I was winning racing BMX, that seemed way more intriguing to me because there was just no rules to follow. And I really loved that freestyle aspect of it, of like, man, these guys are just trying to come up with tricks here in the grass. So,
and were they doing jumps and stuff? Were they like,
no, they were trying flatland tricks in the grass.
Okay.
So, so eventually I stopped going to the track, and I got me a more freestyle bike, and that freestyle bike led me to a bike shop that was here in Hammond, Louisiana. And, I started hanging out there, doing tricks in their parking lot all day. My mom would bring me there when I was, I don't know, 10, 11 years old. I would hang out at that bike shop all day. And eventually from hanging out at that shop, that bike shop, started like a freestyle team, and it was me and two other guys. And we were doing like box jump shows. We were going to like fairs, and I was like tiny. I was like a 11, 12 year old kid at this time. And I could do a little bit of flatland back then. But again, I was around these other two guys, and anyone that I came across, they could do a tiny bit of flatland, but for the most part, we were jumping ramps. And the little bit of flatland that I knew, it wasn't highly skilled flatland. It was just a couple balancing tricks on the ground. And from there, sorry for this big run-on story, but from there was a group of guys in New Orleans, and they were calling around different bike shops trying to find riders. And this was this group of riders was flatland riders, and they called the bike shop that I was at, and the bike shop was like, yeah, there's this little kid, Terry, here. He's really good. We'll give you his number. We sponsor him. And so those guys called me, and they were like, yeah, what tricks can you do? And I knew names of flatland tricks, but I didn't really know what the tricks were. So I lied through my teeth. I was a kid. Every word that I knew that was a flatland trick, but I didn't know the movements. I was like, yeah, I can do this, this, this. And the guy was like, man, we definitely going to come and ride with you. So anyway, that was the start of flatland, because when they showed up to my town to ride with me, they were expecting something completely different. You know, they showed up, and I was just like a kid at a skate park with these shin guards and this this shirt that was 10 sizes too big. I can only do a couple tricks that I said I could do. But I just got so intrigued by those guys and their style, their what Flatland meant to them, their bike setups. Yeah. And from that day forward, kind of changed everything. I became completely obsessed with trying to impress these group of guys from New Orleans. And one of those guys, Mickey Guidos, is a best friend of mine, and I'm still riding with him every day. So.
Nice one. And were you kind of looking at those guys and then sort of looking at the magazines and thinking, you know, that was sort of where you wanted to be back then? Or were you just doing your own thing and kind of trying to hang with the guys? And
yeah, I mean, something changed after I, after I became obsessed with trying to impress those three guys, then something kind of clicked in my head that I want to be a professional BMX flatland rider. And I didn't really know what that entailed. I didn't know that that meant I was going to get money. I didn't know that it meant I would need to get sponsors or learn a bunch of original tricks or travel and compete. All I really knew is like, I wanted to be in the magazines like the pros, because those guys are pros and they're in the magazines. So my obsession actually became impressing these guys to trying to impress the world of BMX Flatland, which was a difficult thing to do because I was from Louisiana, and a lot of the industry was in California, and yeah. And Flatland is very niche. It's one of the smallest parts of BMX. So I didn't really know that. I knew that when I scrolled through a 200-page magazine, that would only be 10 pages of Flatland, but I just focused on those 10 pages, and I would rip out the 10 pages and stick them on my wall. And to eventually the wall of my bedroom as a kid was floor to ceiling, all the walls completely covered in Flatland. And my obsession became like, I'm going to be in the magazines just like these guys. So that's where that obsession kind of began, of like, yeah, becoming a pro.
And would you just sort of like, would you focus on like learning new tricks and just trying to absorb as much as you can, like from those guys? And it would just be like all encompassing, right? So you just want to kind of do it the whole time. And
yeah, well, the cool thing about Flatland is the guys that really stand out are doing their own tricks, and it very teeters that line of art and sport. And it was really art back then, because there was no like, you know, super heavy competitions that were, you know, so many rules like there are now. Yeah. So really during my obsession to become a pro, I just kind of knew like, I need to come up with some like really like banger tricks that really stood out, to where when I do show up to a contest, I stand out. So that also became like another addiction / obsession of like trying to come up with these tricks that made me stand out over like maybe the average rider that was my age that was showing up at these contests. So.
And when did you start, like when did all the competition start? Was that sort of around like,
yeah,
like 15, 16, that kind of thing, or?
No, I was 12 or 13. So kind of the moment, I got that first flatland bike, I really started to become fixated on the X Games was a big thing back then. Flatland was in the X Games back then. And so I was always watching it on TV, and there was all these X Games trials that were happening around the US. And there was one that was popping up in Orlando at the Wide World of Sports. So that was the first event my stepdad drove me to. And, yeah. So even though it was like a qualifier for the ESPN X Games, there was an expert class that I could enter. So that was my first event.
Were you sort of trying to seek out sponsors? So after you had the shop,
kind of sponsor you, were you trying to reach out to them, or were they coming to you, or like how did that all happen?
Yeah, you know, sometimes my obsessions get the best of me. So even at such a young age, I was, man enough to admit now, I was definitely chasing that sponsor dream way too early. I was definitely fixated on trying to get sponsored, but you know, I learned a lot back then from trying to seek those sponsors at such a young age. An example, when I was 13, there was a payphone at this campground that I practiced flatland at every day. And I would go to the payphone every day and I would dial 1-800-RIDE-A-GT because it was a toll-free number. And I would get Woody Itzen on the phone, which was their team manager at the time that put together all of their freestyle shows and built their team. And I would get him on the phone almost every day. I would finish riding and I would call that 1-800 number and tell Woody what tricks I was learning and tell him I wanted to get sponsored. And yeah, I remember a couple conversations that he had with me, but one in particular, he said, "Man, you just got to stop worrying about getting sponsored. Just if you want to keep me updated and let me know what tricks you're learning, you know, you're young, you have a long road ahead of you. Just keep riding and keep having fun." And, but you know, guys like that were always so nice to pick up the phone and speak to me. I mean, here I am, a 13-year-old kid, just, you know, calling these guys that are, you know, probably in their late 20s, early 30s. And I'm, you know, trying to get sponsored. They always picked up the phone. They always spoke to me and they always told me, "Send me tapes, you know, let us see how good you're getting." And man, I took that stuff to heart. So I was constantly, you know, having my mom film with a huge camera, you know, like recorder on her, just like this. And I would start those videos off like, you know, "Hey Woody, here I am. I'm here in the parking lot. Want to show you what tricks I learned." So, it's really cool to go back now 30 years later and know that all those guys that I was sending the videos to, they remember that stuff. And, I'm so grateful that none of those guys were, rude to me or hung up the phone on me. They just knew I was some young kid from Louisiana that wanted to get sponsored, and they dealt with me and put up with me. And in the end, it did kind of work in my advantage, because when I did start making my way to contests, and the photographers from the magazines were running around trying to figure out who to shoot a photo of that was an up and comer, sometimes I felt like they kind of gravitated to me because I was also calling the magazines as a young kid, because they had numbers in the magazines. So being in Louisiana, in my mind, man, the only way I can get a hold of, you know, the only way I can, you know, talk to the right person is call them. So I don't know what was in my mind to do that, but I definitely called the magazines quite a bit as a kid. So when I showed up at the events, the photographers kind of was like, "Oh, this is Terry Adams. This kid calls us all the time. He calls our office." So,
it's cool that you did that. I mean, you could have just got early on, you could have got a no or like a setback and then almost lost your confidence with it. Right. And going, you know, like maybe I won't call them. Maybe I won't kind of pursue it, but.
Yeah. You know, since it was such a dream of mine, remember I told you the dream of mine was to be in the photos of those magazines. So the closest thing to getting a photo in the magazines was to like talk to the people that worked at the magazine. So when you want something that bad as a kid, you start scrolling through the magazine and you find a number. And so that's what I did. And what was giving me a little bit of motivation was sometimes when I would call, they would talk about it in the news of the, there's like a news section in the magazine. And I would start to read the news when the magazine would come and it would say, "Terry Adams called us again to let us know he didn't get third place. He actually got second place in St. Petersburg, Florida." And when I started realizing like they're mentioning me in the news, in my mind, I'm like, I'm one step closer to like actually getting getting a photo in this thing. So I have a stack of magazines from the 90s that I kept where they were just mentioning me in the news because because I just kept calling. And eventually, you know, I went to Louisville, Kentucky to one of the X trials. I was 15, and one of those photographers kind of migrated over to the Flatland area. He knew he needed a picture of one of the up and coming Flatland guys that was in the expert class. And for whatever reason, he kind of migrated over to me, and that ended up being my first photo in Ride BMX magazine. And I always kind of attributed that to, I don't know if this is true or not, but I always attributed to, it's like, yeah, he knew about me because I was calling the publication all the time. But I'm still friends with that guy, and I've reached out to him multiple times for, you know, in my mind, that was kind of the start of like getting.
Was that the breakthrough moment then, you reckon? Like, that was kind of
definitely in my mind it was, because since I wanted that so bad, I wanted to be like, you know, on a page in a magazine that was like next to another page that had like Dave Mirra, Matt Hoffman in it, you know, like, yeah. I just wanted that so bad. So the photo was relatively small, and but when the magazine came in the mail, man, it was like all those phone calls and all that bike riding paid off, because I took the magazine and I took off running. I left my house, and I don't know where I was going, but I just ran and ran and ran. I was so happy. I wasn't headed to anyone's house. I didn't have a plan in sight, but to just run with this magazine and scream at the top of my lungs. But again, that's a goal that not a lot of BMX riders might have to be fixated on. But in those early years, it's really what kept me motivated, was to get some type of recognition from the BMX industry.
Yeah. And then were you kind of like focused on competitions as well, right? And performing and like, obviously, you know, getting on podium and winning comps, and then I guess all the traveling aspect of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It was all just a big obsession to get known. And when I started to get more photos in magazines, I started to realize that those photos can then lead to sponsors, because the companies are going to see that I'm getting recognition. And then I started to see, like, well, I'm getting in the magazines, like, how do I get in these VHS tapes? So I was very feet on the ground at the events, to where if I showed up to an event at an early age, when most of the riders would just be practicing, I would be practicing getting ready. But I kind of knew from that first photo that happened in Louisville, that the photographers sometimes don't know which person to go to. And sometimes they were a little bit timid on, like, you know, oh, can we interrupt your practice to shoot a quick photo for the magazine? I kind of knew, like, from that one experience, that when I seen a photographer, that's what they were doing. Like, they were looking to get a photo for the magazine. So I started going up to all the photographers at every event, and that's kind of how I started integrating my name into the industry. Is I kind of knew to seek out those photographers at every event, shake their hand, you know, tell them I'm down to shoot a quick photo. And I just started compiling all these magazines of all these images I would get from these contests. So,
yeah. And you were kind of like, from pretty early on, like writing down goals and kind of like having action plans, right? It wasn't something where you would just be like winging it and trying to make a name for yourself. You actually did like put a plan together.
Yeah, it started off with just writing like trick goals, you know, to where, like, you know, here's five tricks I want to learn. And I still saved all these notebooks, and I still have them. And I start off with writing these trick goals. And sometimes a flatland trick, you know, even today, it could take you 5 months to learn. So I didn't realize it, but at such a early age, I was learning something really valuable through Flatland, which was accomplishing goals through hard work. And when I took that mentality of hard work with the tricks I was trying to do and come up with, and I transferred it over to the business side of riding, which was obtaining sponsors and then keeping those sponsors, I felt like it was like another wall I broke through, because although Flatland is really small, I found a way to market myself through hard work that was, I was really showing the companies really early on that I was gonna, you know, maybe outwork everyone that was, you know, that they had worked with. And,
yeah,
you know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but in my mind, that's kind of how I thought of, like, I just didn't want to take it for granted. And I don't know, I think back and, you know, it was way before Instagram, and this was like early 2000s. I was the rider that was like, I was probably sending these companies that I rode for like hundreds of emails of just sending them the smallest updates. But, you know, they never had to worry about what I was doing, if I was riding, even if it was as simple as me going on a trip that didn't have to do with riding, to let them know that, like, hey, I'm going to be away from my email a couple days. Like, I almost became, again, obsessed with treating the sponsorship like a job, because I didn't want it to end. To where, I don't want to say it got the best of me, but there were years when I did it so much, I almost had too many sponsors, to where I thought, man.
Is there such a thing as that?
It'd
be too many commitments, right? So you kind of be like pulled in too many different directions with them, or?
No, it was more or less, I was taking deals that didn't really fit me.
Okay.
You know, there was times when my bike just looked like a NASCAR. There was so many different brands on. Yeah, there were brands that just necessarily maybe didn't fit my style. There were companies that I didn't necessarily believe in 100%, but since I had, like, in my mind, I had, like, not only accomplished this goal of being a pro rider, I feel like I had, like, learned that, like, the hard work with the business side of things was able to give me more money, which gave me more opportunities. It almost became this vicious cycle of, like, man, if I just keep showing every company that I can work this hard, it was a pretty easy sell to them, because they could tell right off the bat that I was going to overwork myself for not a whole lot of money. And in my mind, the amount of money was never a thing. It was more or less like, I can't believe I'm getting paid to ride my bike. So there were times when, like I said, the bike was just covered in stickers, to where if I was a company and I looked at this kid's bike or this guy's bike, I would go, man, that's just, he's got too much going on. A lot of these brands don't really align with what we're doing. So now it's pretty easy for me to look back and realize that, it maybe wasn't a mistake. I learned a lot from it, but now, I'm very happy with all the, you know, I'm very strategic, and the brands that I align myself with and the brands that I've been with for a very long time, to where now I'll think twice about getting involved in something that's not, something that really fits me.
Yeah. And you were kind of doing, like, trying to get involved with the show business side of things as well, weren't you? And kind of like, there's a bit of a story with getting on the Ellen show, and, you know, there's a few things that you were kind of like, the bits and pieces you were doing. Was that kind of, like, looking back on it, do you reckon that was obviously to kind of put Flatland out there,
yeah,
and grow what it would be growing your personal brand, but also the sport. And
yeah, I mean, I hate to keep using the word obsession, but it definitely became another thing where I when I was getting the photos in the magazines, I started to realize, like, man, like, we're always in the magazines, but we're never on the cover. Okay, so yeah, I went back to that old school mentality of calling the magazines when I was a kid, and I started calling the magazines as an adult, and now these guys know who I am for many years, and mm-hmm. I started, like, asking for covers, which is something you just don't do in BMX. But the first one I called Ride BMX Magazine, that gave me that first photo in Louisville when I was 15, and I said, yeah, I got a trick. It's really crazy. I would love to get it on the cover. And they're like, Terry, we can never, like, guarantee a cover. You know, we don't do that. And I'm like, well, this trick is crazy. I think it would look good on the cover. And the guy that I was speaking with said, look, if you come out here, Los Angeles, you shoot the trick, you never know where it's going to end up. So that was just his kind of way of saying, like, yeah, dude, whatever. You know, but it was enough validation for me to, like, get on the plane, go to LA and shoot this trick, because it might be a sliver of hope that Flatland can get on the cover. Cause I think it had been like 10 or 12 years since we had had a cover here in the US. So I shot the trick. It ended up being on the cover, and it was like a huge eye opener for me. And it almost lit a fire for, man, we do deserve to be in the spotlight. We do deserve to be in the media. So that goal of putting Flatland on the cover then trickled into wanting to get Flatland on TV, which led me to the Glee and the Ellen and all these commercials I did. And in those early 2000s, you know, 2008, 2012, I was just kind of on, like, a mission rampage to, like,
were you hustling it the same way? Were you, like, calling up production companies and...
Bro, it was crazy. It was crazy. Yeah, I was calling the Ellen Show for, like, 5 years. Yeah. I've told the story many times, but I was sending VHS tapes to the Ellen Show. And one time they gave me a callback and they were like, yeah, we got your tape. We would love for you to come on the show on Tuesday. And I was like, yeah, I've been trying. Let's do this. And so they were like, we'll call you back. It was like on a Friday. They're like, we'll call you back this weekend. We'll book your flight. Well, they never called. And I was devastated. I'm like, I tried all these years and now they're not calling. But the mistake they made was they didn't, like, block their number. So now I had this, like, weird number to their production office that had an answering machine. So then I spent a good year or two calling and leaving messages, like, yeah, this is Terry again. Like, you guys called and said I was going to be on the show. And I called that number so many times and left so many messages. I just had that never give up attitude where, like, I just could see myself riding on that show. And eventually they called, and it was kind of another breakthrough moment in my head of, like, when I did get on that stage and did ride on the show, even though it was like a little talent segment, it was definitely another eye opener to me that, man, if you don't give up on something that you want, whether it's a trick, being in a magazine, being on a magazine cover, being on the Ellen Show, no matter what that goal is, as long as you just keep fighting for it, you're going to get it. And really it all kind of goes back to me writing down those goals as a kid, trying to learn these tricks, of that mindset of something that might take me 5 months to learn. I'm now taking that same mindset as an adult, to get on a TV show. So yeah, to answer your question, that was definitely all those were personal goals of mine, mm-hmm. to break into that world. But it was also like, it all stemmed from that magazine cover to, like, I just felt so deep in my heart that Flatland deserved to be in the forefront. It became something that I was really fixated on for many years. So,
yeah, nice. And like, what would you say from a sort of Flatland perspective? Like winning gold at X Games, like, and then getting Nora's as well. I mean, you won like sort of like best rider of the year 3 times. I mean, was there sort of like, now looking back, has there sort of been a highlight, or is it sort of, it's just been different stages of your life that, from a sort of riding perspective?
Yeah. I guess if I look back at like the, any accomplishment that I'm most proud of, it is the Nor Cups, mm-hmm. just because those are voted, by the industry. And, you know, I won in 2005 and 2008 and 2020, and they were, I look back at how I won each one, and it was very different scenarios for each one. So 2005, I was a kid that was just riding so hard, just trying to get my name out there. And I didn't even realize that I was making an impact in the Flatland world, to the point where I wasn't at the award ceremony. They called me, they told me I should be there. And I instead wanted to do a show at this Jennifer Lopez fashion show. So I wasn't even at the Nor Cup Awards that year. And they had to call me from the stage and say, "Terry, you won. We told you to be here." And I'm like, "Oh man." So I didn't even show up. And then in 2008, I was in that point of my career where I was hustling so hard. It's crazy to go back and admit this, but I took that strategy of calling people to ask them to vote for me. And that's something that is just not something you do for a Nor Cup, but man, I'm just honest enough to say it. That I pretty much knew everyone that was getting a ballot, and I sent out so many emails, bro, like saying like, "Hey, this is what I did this year."
These would be to friends as well, right? It's not like you don't know these people. It's
all my friends and guys that I compete against. And I was like, "Hey, I feel like I had a really good year. I would love it if you voted for me." So I kind of took this approach of like self-marketing myself to win that Nor Cup in 2008. It was great. I love that I was able to do that. I'll never do it again, but it's kind of, you know, no one's ever going to do that, ask people to vote for them, especially ask so many people. But the fact that I did it once and it worked, I'll never do it again. And then this last Nor Cup in 2020 was during the pandemic, and it was my son was born in 2018. I had gotten completely remotivated with riding. And during the pandemic, one of my good friends and Red Bull teammates started this online game of bike to keep mm-hmm. all of us occupied. And it was basically just like 7 of us around the world were just playing a game of bike, kind of like a game of horse or pig. Yeah. But we were trying to learn each other's tricks back and forth on Instagram and kind of showing the world this like game. Well, during this game, I became obsessed with wanting to win. And I ended up winning the game because we were given each other 24 hours to learn each other's tricks that we presented. And so I won the game. And then I got a phone call from Matthias one day, and he was saying in a very nice, friendly way, he was being a great friend, that, "Man, I noticed something from the game of bike. You have a lot more potential in you these years than you give on the bike." And I was, at the time, my ego was in the way, and I just didn't understand that he was trying to give me advice. And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And in his mind, he was telling me like, "Bro, you just learned all these tricks for this game. You can really push yourself and like have another Terry comeback." And yeah, again, my ego was in the way. And I literally got off the phone and like sent him a text message and was like, hey bro, like don't tell me like don't tell me how to ride my bike. You ride your bike and I'll ride my bike. But that was so wrong of me. Like he was
just trying to help, right?
All he was doing was like, Terry, bro, you just learned all these tricks. Like and he's like, I forgot how good you are on your bike. Like that obsession that you just took with the game, bro, you should take that to your riding. And I just took it the complete wrong way. And so after I get off the phone with him, then I go on this like insane mission to like learn a bunch of tricks. And I'm in my garage and I'm learning all these tricks. And after every trick that I learn and post, I'm like slamming my feet down on the pedals, almost out of anger and ego, because I'm just so mad that, you know, here's, you know, one of my best friends is trying to give me advice, but I'm mad that he gave me advice. And the whole time I'm thinking I'm proving him wrong by learning all these tricks, but I'm actually proving him right, because that's what he was telling me I could do. He was saying, yeah, like, Terry, you have all this talent. Like, what are you doing? Use it. So I learned all those tricks, and I feel like that year of 2020 is what won me that Nor Cup. So I always said like ego kind of won that Nor Cup for me, you know, good or bad. That's what happened. And it took like months and months after I won that Nor Cup to realize how wrong I was, and taking what he told me. And I called him one day and was like, bro, I gotta apologize and thank you, because I realized that day you were calling me, it was out of love, and it was out of you just, you know, being stoked for me, and you wanted to see me do well with my riding again. And I'm very grateful that he's a friend that would like tell me what's up, because that's kind of what he was telling me. He's like, bro, you have the ability to do it, but you're not going to do it with the way you're going now. You got to take the same mentality that you have with this game of bike and take it into the BMX world like you did years ago. And yeah, grateful to have friends that'll actually tell you what's up. Yep. So those are hard to come by.
So is that the plan then for this year? Is that like sort of what you're going to do? And have you got goals set up and events that you're going to be competing in? And
yeah, I mean, the goal when I first had my son in 2018 was to, I say, be the best again, but it didn't really mean like be the best on the top of the contest world. It pretty much in my mind meant to be the best I've ever been on my bike. So that's what I've been really working towards since 2018. And, you know, in the early 2000s, late 90s, I rode a lot, but I've never ridden this smart. So now, now I take rest days. Now I work out every day. I do the meditation. I'm eating properly. I'm putting the proper foods in my body that's giving me the right amount of energy to sustain the amount of hours that I'm riding. You know, years ago, I didn't think of any of that stuff. I just rode all day, which was great. And it brought me really far. But now at 38 years old, I realized to keep this level of riding up, I have to take those rest days. I have to put the proper foods in my body. And, so yeah, the goal is to keep pushing forward and definitely, be the best that I can be. And, you know, I guess in a sense, keep one-upping myself. And if that means just, you know, getting stronger every day or getting more fluid on the bike, then it's crazy, because for years and years there was always different things that motivated me to keep riding flatland, and different, I got different spurts. And if you would have told me 20 years ago that man, one day you're gonna have a riding coach that you speak to every day and helps you, you know, put together your routine and talk about riding and contest strategies, I would have just looked at you like you were crazy and said, no way, bro, this is freestyle. But here I am, 38 years old, and I have a riding coach, and it keeps me extremely motivated to have him on my team and to work with him daily on what, you know, the plan for the next contest and where we're going forward.
And he would just then give you different perspectives as well, right? So instead of, you don't have to kind of take it all on yourself, and you can kind of work together with him. And
yeah, because, you know, I'm the type of guy that gets, when I have a goal, sometimes I don't proceed forward on the best route possible. I just get fixated on one way, that the only way I know how to do it, which is just like ride all day, ride all day, ride all day. But he working with him since 2018, we've tried many different ways of training to where we've kind of figured it out to where, like, okay, this is your sweet spot. We know you need to be riding like this a month before the contest. We know you need to be doing this many hours 2 weeks before the contest. We know it's going to keep you relaxed the day of the event. And it's taken a while for him and I to figure out that sweet spot, but we definitely did it together, and I couldn't have did it alone, you know, because my way would have just been like, I'm just going to ride all day like I did when I was, you know, 15, 18, 21 years old. And that was my way of doing it. So to have that extra eye to help out has been game changing. And, you know, every week we do a simulated contest over Zoom. So with all the other riders that he coaches, we get on a Zoom call on every Wednesday, and we all compete against each other and do our contest run. And what's great about that is you get nervous just like in a contest, because he's judging us, and then you're going against some of the top riders in the world that he coaches. Yeah. So you're kind of put on the spot, and even though it's a Zoom call, you still only get one try. So if you do have some mistakes, you have a week to kind of reflect on what you did wrong and what you can change. And that's been a huge game changer for myself and for my riding, to not only to have that Zoom call to look forward to, but and learn from every week, but to keep me on my toes of like knowing that it's almost like having a contest every week. So in a time like this where events are getting canceled, and with COVID going on, and just not as many events happening, it's been rad to pretty much have like a contest in my garage every week to kind of,
that's cool.
Yeah. Keep me very sharp.
And also, I mean, you're kind of doing like other things as well, right? I mean, you were investing in property, and like, this is kind of really early on when you sort of were looking at, you know, what happens, I guess, almost like life after competing and like after BMX. How are you balancing all that, like then and now? I mean,
you know, just my personality, when the moment it kind of hit me that, man, one day that these checks that come in the mail from riding my bike, it is going to, there'll be a day where they're not coming. I knew that I need to set something up. I knew I needed to do something, but I didn't know what. I didn't know anything about real estate. I didn't know anything about investing. Honestly, I didn't know anything about money management. The parking lot that I used to ride in, I was riding out there one day. I was 17, 18 years old, and a guy pulls up in his truck and he says, like, man, you can't ride here. He was in his 50s at the time. And I said, oh, yeah, I can ride here. And he goes, no, you can't ride here. I own this property. And I was like, oh, wow. So really quick, I pulled up my pants, I put on my shirt, and turned down my rap music that was playing in the car. And I'm like, man, I'm preparing for a contest in Portugal right now, the World Championships. I really want to ride here. This is my only spot to ride. And the guy was like, okay, well, if you're serious, come to my office and I'll write you out a permission slip to ride here and saying that, you know, I won't be liable if you get hurt. That guy ended up being not only my financial mentor, but he like owns like 60, 70% of my entire town. So after that day, he would always stop out in the parking lot because I showed up at his office that morning after and I got the permission slip. He would stop out in the parking lot while I was riding and he would give me financial advice and tell me what I need to do with the little bit of money that I had coming in. And I became extremely great friends with him, and he's still around. I still get advice from him, and it's because of him that kind of really started me on that journey of paying attention to the money that's coming in and what I need to be doing with it. Really grateful that I met him, because if I wouldn't have met him, I wouldn't have kind of set up this afterlife of, you know, what am I going to do? And it all happened from me just riding Flatland out in his parking lot. It's crazy. He's like, you know, in his mid 70s right now and still go to his office. You know, now I've been doing the investing stuff so long. I ended up buying a property from him 2 years ago that was one of his first properties. And it's just been such a great relationship, because he could have easily been a guy that said, dude, I don't care what you're doing out here. I don't care where you're going. Get off of my property. I don't want you here. But he was nice enough to kind of take me under his wing and give me that advice. So again, the investing stuff, it definitely became an obsession over the years to where I knew that I needed it. And thankfully I had guys like him to really help me out and kind of steer me in the right direction.
Nice. Cool. Have you got anything that you're going to be like working on later this year?
Riding wise?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, it's nonstop all year, really. So April, Flatland is back in the X Games. After 19 years. Yeah, after 19 years, it's back in the X Games. So that's a big deal. I'm an invited rider to that. So I'll be headed over there in April. Then in May, there's the FIS event that is a UCI FIS.
Yeah, over in Montpellier.
Yeah, that'll be at the end of May. Then early June, I'm doing a big project, secret project with Red Bull. On my Instagram, you see me. I built a stage for that project out in my backyard to kind of test the stage yesterday. And then early June, the first ever UCI American Championships will be held in Arkansas. So that's just a few coming up, but there's definitely, it'll be a packed year. And it looks like the COVID stuff is slowing down a little bit. So that's exciting to know that I'm riding so hard and working so hard over here that there's actually be some events to show up to. So
nice. And if people want to follow you, what's the best way?
Best way is I keep my Instagram updated. It's Terry Adams BMX. Terry Adams BMX. And my Facebook, I believe, is Terry Adams BMX. And my TikTok, I think, is Terry Adams BMX 5. But for the most part, I throw everything on Instagram and then kind of trickle the same content over to the other platforms. So,
nice one. Cool. Well, Terry, man, thanks so much for coming on the show. It was really, really good chatting to you, and good luck with everything that's coming up this year. And sounds like a pretty busy schedule. You're kind of going to be back to back with events and hope it all goes well, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure, and happy to tell my story and hopefully inspire someone out there to do what they love and to not give up.
Thanks, man.
Cheers. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. As always, you can find show notes and links to resources on radseason.com/magazine. Hit us up on Instagram at radseasonpodcast. You can follow me on Ollie Russell Cowan. Until next time, thanks for listening.